Good morning to all of you. Thank you, Mark. He couldn't have provided a better introduction to my sermon that's been marinating in my mind for some time, as it's based on the very same psalm. Psalm 23 is one of the most oft-quoted psalms in common usage, and it's numbered among the 70-something psalms that David authored. And he was written apparently later in his life because of the depths of experience that it brings forth. David was a warrior, a king, a poet, a songwriter. He was obviously a very capable and complex individual. He was also a man of many failures. He was did great exploits, sinned greatly, repented in ways that we probably can't understand, and yet carries the title of being a friend of God and a man after God's own hearts. It is this complexity, this dichotomy, if you will, this dramatic life that brings depth of meaning and timeless nature to the words he wrote millennia ago. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in the path of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk in the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup runs over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. There is so much depth to these words written by a man equipped by wisdom that can only be shaped on the forge, be forged through the years of experience and a very difficult life. It is actually the case that, you know, this is a succinct psalm. More words have been written in an attempt to plumb the depth of its meaning than the words of the psalm itself. And that is also why it has fascinated and connected with people down through millennia. Today I want to bring our focus on just one phrase in this psalm, showing how it has worked in the past, how it can work for us today, and how it will yet shape the future. In fact, we will learn that this psalm is a kind of a metaphor for some of the things that have happened in the past and in the future. And the phrase is this: yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Now, I'll be direct. I'd like to squash any Pollyannish notions about the poetic nature of this with a statement that I will read and then prove to you. The valley of the shadow of death can be more hellish than death itself. That's a strong statement. I recognize that. Death, to be sure, and, you know, I've called this the summer of sorrows. We've had so many people close to us die, and we are very familiar with its sting. But the valley of the shadow of death can be more difficult than death itself. The phrase, the valley of shadow of death in Psalm 23, comes from the Hebrew word ge-tzalmaveh. Probably mispronounced it. And here's a breakdown of its hellish or darker meaning. It is an abyss of mortal danger. Actually, the English version of translation of the word ge is valley, but chasm might be a more appropriate translation, or it has as is so often the case, Hebrew is a very flexible language and has nuances of meaning that is often very difficult to translate. Abyss of mortal danger, a symbolic place of near death or extreme peril, cosmic darkness. In Hebrew poetry, this word is often associated with thick darkness, chaos, and death, even demonic or spiritual danger. Spiritual desolation. The phrase can be read as a metaphor of utter despair or godless abandonment, which some interpret as, quote, hellish. This word, perhaps not surprisingly, is used most often in the book of Job. Let's go to Job chapter 10. We'll just look at one. Job chapter 10. Job chapter 10, and we'll look at verse 21 and 22. Before I go to the place from which I shall never return, to the land of darkness and the shadow of death, a land as dark as darkness itself, as the shadow of death without any order, where even light is like darkness. You think about that, where even light is like darkness. I mean, there, metaphorically speaking, that covers a vast chasm. Let's go to Jeremiah. You know, Job, I mean, it goes without saying, was an individual who fell into very difficult times at the behest of Satan. And, you know, a lot of good people have suffered greatly. In fact, it almost seems like the greater the suffering, the greater the individual. And there is a psychological component to that. But here in Jeremiah chapter 13, this word appears. And then we'll turn a little bit later into the book and see when this actually happened to the prophet himself. Jeremiah chapter 13, verse 16, give glory to the Lord your God before he causes darkness and before your feet stumble on dark mountains. And while you are looking for light, he turns it into the shadow of death and makes it dense darkness. Jeremiah, the prophet, you know, spoke truth and suffered consequences. And we find that over in Jeremiah chapter 38. You know, we see this, there are certain things that just keep replaying through time. In Jeremiah chapter 38, we read in verse 2, thus says the Lord, he who remains in this city shall die by the sword, by famine, and by pestilence, but he who goes over to the Chaldeans shall live. His life shall be as a prize to him, and he shall live. Thus says the Lord, this city shall surely be given into the hand of the king of Babylon's army, which shall take place. Now that was not politically expedient for him to say that in the court of the king. I think sometimes we forget, I mean, these prophets and the personalities of the Old Testament, I mean, they, and we'll get to the family of Jacob in a little bit later. I mean, they had a degree of prominence, and Jeremiah had an audience with the king. But notice what the king's advisors said. Therefore the princes said to the king, please let this man be put to death, for thus he weakens the hands of the men of war by saying, you know, we're going to be defeated. It was true. He spoke truth. But it was not a popular message. Who remain in this city and the hands of all the people by speaking such words to them, for this man does not seek the welfare of the people, but their harm. Then Zedekiah the king said, look, he is in your hand, for the king can do nothing against you. So they took Jeremiah and cast him into the dungeon of Malchiah the king's son, which was in the court of the prison, and they let Jeremiah down with ropes. And in the dungeon, there was no water but mire. I think that's a euphemism for, you might as well have said septic tank. Okay? So Jeremiah sank in the mire. It seems to me that it would have been better for him to have been executed than to go to this really dark place. And of course, interestingly enough, it was an Ethiopian eunuch that pled with the king, and they lifted him back out. So, yea, though I walk in the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. We see, we can take a couple of additional points from here. It talks about walking through. I mean, this is almost like living death and walking through it. It's in death's shadow. And you suffer and walk through it. Fear no evil. It's interesting that the Hebrew word for evil here is ra, which is the Hebrew word for evil in general. But I thought it was interesting, as I remembered this from, you know, whenever you study about the plagues in Egypt, one of the Egyptian gods was named Ra. I'm not sure about the linguistic connection. But it was an Egyptian sun god, this Ra was. The quintessential evil. So, you know, if you look at the multidimensional aspect of this of the words in this psalm, you begin to realize why it's got so much depth. So in the Hebrew poetry, you have a word for evil that, among other things, was the name of an Egyptian god. And David's saying, yea, though I walk through this valley of death that can be more hellish than death itself, I will fear no evil, not even an Egyptian sun god. Those are powerful words that David no doubt was able to write because he had experienced it himself. David's life was tough. I mean, he suffered. He did great exploits. I mean, we think about him, you know, killing Goliath and conquering the Philistines and collecting countless foreskins and all of those things we like to talk about. But this is the same David that fled from Saul for years, that was betrayed in the most horrendous way by his own son. There was a lot of depth in the man that wrote this. And then you have this thing, yea, though I walk. I mean, it's almost an Hebrew equivalent of the modern so what. If I walk in the valley of the shadow of death, I will still fear no evil. So you have this, and I'll repeat this, so you have this dramatic contrast. So what if I walk through this hellish chasm called the shadow of death, I still will fear no evil nor wrath of an Egyptian sun god. So that is the phrase of focus. The question is, why could David write this with so much, almost a dismissive approach to it? So what if I walk through the valley of the shadow of death? The answer is actually in the very next verse. For you are with me. So David's confidence came from the fact that even in the chasm of darkness and all the dark places that he had experienced and been, and that people have experienced and been, he could do that. He could almost be dismissive of it because he said, for you are with me. David described this in more detail in Psalms. Let's go there. Psalms chapter 137. Psalm 137. Psalm 137. Well, it's not the right psalm. I know the psalm, so I'll do a bad job of paraphrasing it. It's the psalm that says, "Where can I go to hide from your presence? You know, behold, if I am on a high mountain, you are there. Behold, if I'm in the depths of hell, you are there. You cannot escape," he says, "the presence of the Lord." And I apologize, but I noted the wrong chapter. Does somebody know which chapter that is in? Ask ChatGPT or, some. Jesus promised us the same thing in Matthew chapter 18, and I want to spend 139. Okay. "Where can I go from your spirit? Or where can I go to flee from your presence? If I ascend into heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the othermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. I say, surely the darkness shall fall on me, even the night shall be light about me. Indeed, the darkness shall not hide from you, but the night shines as the day. The darkness and the light are both alike of you." I mean, David understood this and experienced it. So it should not surprise us in Matthew chapter 18 that Jesus said, and I'll just paraphrase it. He said, "Where two or three are gathered together in my name, I will be there in their midst." I mean, this is a remarkable thing for him to say if you consider the larger context of the chapter. The chapter begins with a debate that was ever recurring among the disciples of Christ, and that was, who is the greatest? And, you know, that has not, that particular tendency apparently is a human thing, because our generation has not escaped it. Who is the greatest? Always vying for position and trying to make a mark. You know what the solution, it's remarkable the solution that Jesus had. Verse 2. "So Jesus called a little child and set him in the midst of them and said, assuredly I say to you, unless you are converted and become as little children, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven, much less have a position in it. Therefore, whoever humbles himself as this little child is greatest in the kingdom of heaven, and whoever receives one little child like this in my name receives me. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were drowned in the depths of the sea." I mean, the English translation doesn't quite give its full impact. Now, Freeman and Dan and some of the German-speaking people in the audience will remember, the German says, "Wo der Meer am tiefsten ist." Not only throw the guy in with a millstone, but throw him in the depths of the sea where it's deepest, just to make sure. I mean, it was a decidedly un-Anabaptist manner of of dealing with people, but we heard this ad nauseum at church years ago. I mean, this, for Jesus to have said that, should tell us something. It tell us a couple of things, you know, about his feeling about children and also his position on vying for power. This is also, you know, I'll just draw the young people, the children, to attention to this. Take a look at verse 10. "Take heed that you do not despise one of the little ones. For I say to you that in heaven there angels see the face of my Father who is in heaven." You know, we've talked about guardian angels, and this particular passage, Jesus says specifically that not only is an angel assigned to a child for their protection, but it is in the plural. So when David wrote that, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death," whatever the trial, the difficulty, the despair that you might find yourself in, "I will fear no evil, for I am with you." And that is from the biggest to the smallest, whether we're talking about stature or prominence. Jesus said that the angels who guard children see my Father's face every day, and woe be it to those who cause them to sin. But perhaps this classic example of walking through the valley of the shadow of death and the Lord being with him is embodied the best in the story of Joseph. And I'd like to take some time and we just go back and review it. The story of Joseph is a classic. But it was interesting to me to see how the story develops and how it fits with the metaphor of the psalm as it developed. So let's go to Genesis chapter 37 and try to figure out how to do this. I mean, the story of Joseph, if you look at the book of Genesis, I mean, I didn't count, but if you just look at the number of pages that are dedicated to the story of Joseph, I think it might have the most space. So that's what we're challenged with here in this sermon. How do we cover all this ground and not leave at 3 o'clock? No worries. I heard somebody respond to that. I mean, I said something that somebody heard, right? If you forget all the rest. Okay, verse 3 of chapter 37. "Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a tunic of many colors." You know, you get the family dynamics going. He loved him more than all the rest. I mean, the scripture says that. So he made him a coat of many colors. "But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Now Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. And he said, 'Please hear the dream which I have dreamt. There we were binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheave arose and also stood upright, and indeed your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheave.' And the brothers said, 'Should you indeed reign over us, or shall you indeed have dominion over us?' So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words." So the sibling rivalry was on its way, and the father supported it to some extent. And Joseph would have been better served, at least in the near term, of not telling his brothers who hated him about his dreams. So you might note, don't tell your dreams to people. I'm talking about, you know, if you're dreaming, not a dream of this sort, but, you know, people have dreams. Don't tell it to people who hate you. I mean, share it with people who will maybe help you support the dream that you're pursuing. Verse 12, "Then his brothers went to feed the father's flock in Shechem, and Israel told Joseph, 'Are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them.' So he said to them, 'Here I am.' And then he said, 'Please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring word back to me.' So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem." So he went out to, this also wasn't the best idea. You know, you send the the son that is your favorite to the brothers who hate him to bring back a report. I mean, what could possibly go wrong? I mean, at best, they beat him up, you know, like good brothers do. And so he went, he found them in Dothan, and they came up with a better scheme, or a worse scheme, I should say. Verse 19, they said to one another, "Look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say some wild beast devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams." So, I mean, this was serious stuff. I mean, they were willing to take action, including killing their brother. I mean, this is, you know, you look at the story within the Bible, you know, we kind of sometimes think we have a Pollyannish, if that's the right word, view of the Bible. And the reality is the very first family had such sibling rivaling that they committed murder. And you look at the example of Jacob's family, I mean, they were plotting to kill their brother. And of course, another one intervened, but Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, "Let us not kill him." So now diplomacy starts. So he compromised. And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood, but cast him into the pit which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him." He did this in order to rescue him later. But that didn't work out so well either, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father. So it came to pass when Joseph had come to his brothers, they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. Yeah, and he even wore his uniform to go see his brothers. I mean, that wasn't very... He was, to a certain extent, an impetuous young man. Then he took him and cast him into the pit, and the pit was empty, and there was no water in it. And then they sat down to eat the meal, and they lifted their eyes and looked. There was coming a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels. So Judah said to his brothers, you know, let's make a deal, okay? I mean, this is the father of the Jewish people today. Let's make a deal and sell him. What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? So they sold him, and, you know, they took his tunic and dipped it in a kid's blood and then sent it to their father and said, you know, we found this. I mean, they made this whole alibi cover story for him. And, of course, Joseph is taken to Egypt. I can't think of a worse situation. It would have been almost better for Joseph if they had followed through and just killed him, as he would have been at rest. Instead, he was taken by strangers to a strange land. And we have this statement in verse 2 that repeats itself throughout the story that I've always wondered about. "And the Lord was with Joseph." It was a God like that who needs an enemy, right? I mean, you've been betrayed by your brothers. You get sent to a foreign land, you did the right thing, and it states, "And God was with him." And he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian, and his master saw that the Lord was with him. I mean, this was even evident to the Egyptian master. The Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all that he did prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in the sight and served him, and then he made him overseer of his house, and all that he had put in his hand. And then the temptress came and said, "Lie with me." And Joseph fled, left his tunic or his whatever he was wearing in her hand. And she then turned that around and showed her master and said, look what this man, this Hebrew that you brought into our household, I mean, the scripture says, was going to mock me, make mockery of me. So Joseph did the right thing, and without trial, was condemned to prison, which we find a story just a few pages over. Verse 20, then Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. But the Lord was Joseph. The Lord was with Joseph in a literal valley of the shadow of death, in a literal dungeon. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy, and he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison, and the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison, whatever they did, and what it was his doing. The keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's hand, because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. So when we go back and we read Psalm 23, and it says, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will be with you. I mean, here is a literal story of what David wrote in the Psalms. You know, he mentioned the word Sheol, in that, you know, you can't escape the presence of the Lord. It is a remarkable example of an individual who fell on hard times for doing the right thing. That in the case of Potiphar's wife, she turned the evidence around in order to cover up what she was attempting to do. And that happens time and time again. I have seen it more often than not, and it usually happens, unfortunately, to the best of people. So here he is in prison, and the prison has dreamers. The prisoners have dreams. So it came to pass after these things that the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt defended their lord. Seemed like this was how things were done back then. I mean, we're so used to due process and hearings and rights and all of that. That's a relatively new phenomenon. I mean, they didn't have rights. It says they offended their lord. I mean, he was in a bad way one day, and he's like, they go off to prison. And Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief butler and the chief baker. I mean, the chief butler and the baker, I mean, they had a really important job, because in the ancient world, there were always attempts on the king's life by poisoning them. So the butler and the baker always had to take a drink and taste the food before the king ate. And if he lived, I mean, this was a highly compensated, dangerous job. So he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard in the prison, the place where Joseph was confined. And the captain of the guard charged Joseph with them, and he served them. So they were in custody for a while. Then the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison, dreamt a dream. Both of them, each dream in one night, and each man's dream with its own interpretation. And Joseph came to them in the morning and looked at them, and they were sad. So he asked the Pharaoh's officers who were with him in the custody of the Lord's house, saying, why do you look so sad today? And they said, we have dreamt a dream, and there is no interpreter of it. So, I mean, dreams, you know, back then, you know, there was always meaning assigned to it, and interpreters made a lot of money giving them meaning. Sometimes they were accurate, and sometimes they were not. So the chief butler told his dream to Joseph and said to him, behold, my dream, a vine was before me, and the vine, there were three branches, and though it budded, the blossoms shot forth, and the clusters brought ripe grapes, and Pharaoh's cup was in my hand and I took the grapes. Long story short, you know, they got restored to their previous positions, and one of them got hanged. And then, you know, Joseph said, if it goes well with you, remember me. Well, see how that worked out. You know, they were happy that they got their positions back and never thought of Joseph again until Pharaoh had a dream. So Pharaoh had this dream, and nobody could interpret it. You know, you had the seven cows, and you had the 7 ears, and you had all that, and the cows ate up the other cows, and the ears ate up the other ears, and nobody could interpret it. And then they came to themselves, and they thought, ah, there was this guy. There was this guy. Verse 9, the chief butler spoke to Pharaoh, saying, I remember my fault this day. When Pharaoh was angry with his servants and put me into custody of the house of the captain of the guard, both me and the chief baker, we each dreamed a dream. In one night, he and I, each of us, dreamed according to the interpretation of his own dream. Now there was a young Hebrew man there, a servant of the captain of the guard, and we told him, and he interpreted our dreams for us, and to each man he interpreted according to his own dream, and it came to pass just as he interpreted for us, so it happened. Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him hastily out of the dungeon, and he shaved, changed his clothing, and came to Pharaoh. He, you know, must have been in a pretty bad sight to behold. But remember, God was with him. Remember, God was with him in this messy place. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I have dreamt a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it, but I have heard it said of you that you can understand and dream a dream to interpret it. So Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, behold, in my dream, I stood on the bank of a river. And then he recounts the dreams that he dreamt. Joseph comes back. Let me see here. Verse 25, then Joseph said to Pharaoh, the dreams of Pharaoh are one. And this is one of the uses of the word, Hebrew word, echad. The dreams of the Pharaoh are one. It's the same word that is used for God is one. Well, here you had two dreams that were one. Just as you have the Word and God, and they are one. That was a bonus point. The two dreams are one. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good heads are 7 years, and the dreams are one. And the seven thin and ugly cows which came up after them are 7 years, and the seven empty heads are blighted by the east wind are 7 years of famine. This is the thing which I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. Indeed, 7 years of great plenty will come throughout the land of Egypt, and then he advised him to store up during the 7 years of plenty, so that they would be able to live through the famine. Verse 37, so the advice was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all his servants, and Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find such a one as this, a man in whom is the Spirit of God? Think about that. Here you had a Egyptian pharaoh who worshipped a long list of deities. And yet, Joseph, who had just emerged from prison, exhibited a demeanor and wisdom so that this pharaoh said, recognize the fact that in him is the Spirit of God. It was the experience in prison, in the depths of the dungeon, and the betrayal of his brothers, and the fact that God accompanied him through all of that, that made this moment that changed the geopolitical landscape and the future of the sons of Jacob forever and continues to shape them to this day, it all tracked back to him being in the valley of the shadow of death, not fearing, because God was there, the Lord was there with him. So, of course, Joseph rose to prominence. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have set over you all of the land of Egypt." And then Pharaoh took his signet ring off his hand and put it on Joseph's hand. And he clothed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. And he had him ride in the second chariot which he had. And they cried out before him, bowed a knee. So he set him over the land of Egypt. I mean, what a transformation. I mean, that's the advantage of dictators. You can go from being a nobody in prison to be second in command in the space of one day. So now all of a sudden, he is in a position to, and he gathered up all the food in the 7 years, and he built, he was a builder, he built warehouses to put it in. It's just a remarkable story. What about what was going on back in the land? Back with the brothers. They had provided their dad with an alibi, a tunic, Joseph's tunic, dipped in blood. You see, not only does David write, "For you will be with me," he also writes, "Your rod and staff comfort me." You know, shepherds are real men, you know, not, you know, these poetic creatures that are in paintings that kind of are half awake sitting in a green field. Shepherds had a rod and a staff. It was the rod of justice. Not only did David say, "Whatever, I walk through the valley of the shadow of death because you will be with me," he said, "I'm comforted by the fact that ultimate justice will be served because you have a rod and you have a staff." Chapter 42. When Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt, Jacob said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another?" And he said, "Indeed, I have heard there is grain in Egypt. Go down to that place and buy for us there that we may not live and not die." And Joseph's 10 brothers came down to Egypt to buy grain, but Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, lest some calamity befall him. And the sons of Israel went down to buy grain, those who journeyed, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. Now Joseph was governor over all the land, and it was he who sold it to all the people of the other lands. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed down before him with their faces to the earth. The dream is going into fulfillment. Not only was God with Joseph, we now run into the metaphorical phase of the rod and the staff. Then Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. Then Joseph remembered the dreams which he had dreamed about them and said to them, "You are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land." And they said to him, "No, my lord, but your servants have come to buy food. We are all one man's son, and we are honest men. Your servants are not spies." And he said to them, "No, but you have come to see the nakedness of the land." And they said, "Your servants are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan, and in fact, the youngest is with our father today, and one is no more." And yet he stood right in front of them. But Joseph said to them, "It is as I spoke to you, saying, 'You are spies. In this manner you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you and let him bring your brother, and you shall be kept in prison, that your words may be tested to see whether there is any truth in you, or else by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies.' So he put them all together in prison for 3 days, and then Joseph said to them on the third day, 'Do this and live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers be confined in your prison house, but you go and carry grain for the famine of your house and bring your youngest brother to me, so your words will be verified and you shall not die.' And they did so. Then they said to one another, 'We are truly guilty concerning our brother, for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear. Therefore, this distress has come upon us.' And Reuben answered them, saying, 'Did I not speak to you, saying, do not sin against the boy? Do not sin against the boy, and you would not listen. Therefore, behold, his blood is now required of us.' But they did not know that Joseph understood them, for he spoke to them through an interpreter. And he turned himself away from them and wept. Then he returned to them again and talked to them, and he took Simeon from them and bound him before his eyes. And Joseph gave command to fill their sacks with grain and restore every man's money to his sack and to give them provision for the journey. So they loaded their donkeys and departed, and they went back to the land, and of course the money was put back in the sack. Then they went to Jacob, their father, in the land of Canaan, and told him all that had happened to them, saying, 'The man who is Lord over the land spoke roughly to us and took us for spies of the country. But we said to him, we are honest men. We are not spies. We are 12 brothers, sons of our father. One is no more, and the youngest is with our father in the land of Canaan. And the man, the Lord of the country, said to us, by this I will know that you're honest men. Leave one of your brothers here with me. Take food for the famine and bring your youngest brother to me, so I shall know that you are not spies, but that you are honest men, and I will deliver your brother to you, and that you may trade in the land.' Then it happened, as they emptied their sacks, that surprisingly each man's bundle of money was in his sack. When they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were very afraid. And Jacob, their father, said to them, 'You have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more. Simeon is no more. And you want to take Benjamin away. All these things are against me.' Then Reuben spoke to his father, saying, 'Kill my two sons if I do not bring him back to you and put him in my hands, and I will bring him back to you.' But he said, 'My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead and he is left alone. If any calamity shall befall him along the way in which you go, then you would bring down my gray hair with sorrow to the grave.'" If this is not the valley, the quintessential valley of the shadow of death, I don't know that I could make up a better story. Now the famine was severe in the land, and it came to pass, when they had eaten up the grain which they had brought from Egypt, that their father said to them, "Go back and buy us a little food." But Judah spoke to him, saying, "The man solemnly warned us, saying, 'You shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. If you send your brother with us, we will go down and buy you food, but we will not send him. If you will not send him, we will not go down. You shall not see my face unless your brother is with you.' And Israel said, 'Why did you deal so wrongfully with me as to tell the man whether you had still another brother?'" Why did you give away the family secrets and the family drama? I mean, that's a fair question. But they said, the man asked us pointedly about ourselves and our kindred, saying, is your father still alive? Have you another brother? And we told him accordingly to these words, could we possibly have known that he would say, bring your brother? I mean, this, you get a little bit more detail into the conversation that occurred in front of Joseph. Then Judah said to Israel, his father, send the lad with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both you and also our little ones. I myself will be surety for him. From my hand you shall require him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever. I mean, this is the same guy that came up with the scheme to sell him. I mean, there is, the rod and the staff of justice over time is inescapable. For if we had not lingered, surely by now we could have returned the second time. Then Israel said to them, if it must be so, then do so. Take the best fruits of the land in your vessels and carry down a present for the man, a little balm, a little honey, spices, myrrh, pistachio nuts, and almonds. You know, Jacob, as the progeny of Abraham, had, these were not just a couple, you know, as they're often depicted, a couple of nomads out there. They had means. And I don't know what the equivalent would be today, but, you know, they had considerable means. Verse 12, take double money in your hand, take it back. Take back that was returned in the mouth of your sacks, perhaps it was an oversight, and take your brother also. And may God Almighty give you mercy before the man, and may he release your other brother, Aunt Benjamin. If I am bereaved, I'm bereaved. When Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the steward of the house, take these men to my house and slaughter an animal and make ready, for these men will dine with me at noon. You know, as I read this, I thought, this must be, and we'll read it in a minute, this must be the quintessential example of preparing a table before me in the presence of my enemies. He literally prepared and dined with the brothers that had sold him into slavery. And the record shows, if we jump over to the kind of the conclusion here, I'll read the conclusion, then I do want to read a couple of the points. Then he took servings to them before him, but Benjamin, he was served five times as much as the others. So what did the brothers do? So they drank and were merry with him. I think it's fair to say they drank a lot. But Joseph was doing here what the psalmist wrote down. He prepared a meal. He spread a table before them in the presence of his enemies. Verse 27. Joseph asked about the well-being of his father. Is your father well? The old man of whom you spoke, is he still alive? And they answered, your servant, our father, is in good health. He is alive. And they bowed their heads down and prostrated themselves. Then he lifted his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son, and said, is this your younger brother of whom he spoke? And he said, God be gracious to you, my son. Now his heart yearned for his brother, so Joseph made haste and sought somewhere to weep. And he went into his chamber and wept there. The capacity that Joseph exhibited here is almost unbelievable. But It is a capacity that I would suggest was developed over time of both being abased and abound and the Lord having been with him through that whole time. He exhibited to them, as we will see in the ensuing chapters, what the psalmist also wrote, "Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life." In chapter 44 and 45, Joseph extends mercy. And I think this is the quintessential example of a leader or an individual in power who he had the power to exact vengeance and instead exacted mercy. but he also did that. I mean, he held his brothers to task. We see that. I think we have just take a few more minutes here because I think it's important to just see what he did. I mean, he put his silver cup in Benjamin's sack, and they had left. See where does I intercept here? So the servant overtook them and spoke to them the same words, and they said, "Why does my Lord say these words? Far be it from us that your servants would do such a thing. Look, we brought back to you from the land of Canaan the money which we found in the mouths of your sacks. How then could we steal silver or gold from your Lord's house? With whomever of your servants it is found, let him die, and we will all be your slaves." So they spoke condemnation on themselves. Then each man, they were so confident in themselves, in their own integrity, that each man speedily let down his sack to the ground, and each opened his sack. So he searched, and he began with the oldest and left off with the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. And then they tore their clothes, each man loaded his donkey, and returned to the city, and Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, and they were still there, and they fell before him on the ground. And Joseph said to them, "What deed is this that you have done? Did you not know that such a man as I can certainly practice divination?" Then Judah said, "What shall we say, my lord? What shall we speak, or how shall we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Here we are, my lord's slaves, both we and also he with whom the cup was found." But he said, "Far be it from me that I should do so, but the man in whose hand the cup was found, he shall be my slave. As for you, go back in peace to your father." Then Judah came near to him and said, "Oh, my lord, please let your servant speak a word in my lord's hearing, and do not let your anger burn against your servant, for you are even like Pharaoh. My lord asked his servants, saying, 'Have you a father or a brother?' And we said to my lord, 'We have a father, an old man, and a child in his old age, who is young, and his brother is dead, and he alone is left of his mother's children.' Then you said to your servants, 'Bring him down to me, that I may set eyes on him.' But you said to your servants, 'Unless your younger brother comes down with you, you shall see the face no more.' So it was when we went up to your servant, my father, that we told him the words of my lord, and our father said, 'Go buy and back and buy us a little food.' And we said, 'We cannot go down without our youngest brother with us.' Then your servant, my father, said to us, 'You know that my wife bore two sons, and the one went out from me, and I said, "Surely he is torn in pieces, and I have not seen him since. But if you take this one also from me, and calamity befalls him, you shall bring down my gray hair with sorrow to the grave. Now therefore, when I come to you, to your servant my father, and the lad was not with us, since his life is bound up in the lad's life, it will happen that he sees that the lad is not with us, that he will die, So your servant will bring down the gray hair of your servant, our father, with sorrow to the grave. For your servant became surety for the lad to my father. If I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame forever. Now therefore, please, let your servant remain instead of the lad as slave to my lord, and the lad goes back with his brothers. For how shall I go up to my father if the lad is not with me, lest perhaps I see the evil that would come upon my father? So Joseph could not restrain himself before those before he stood, and he cried out, "Make everyone go out." And he wept aloud, and the house of the Egyptians heard it. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Does my father still live?" This drama played out writ large down through time. There's actually a future fulfillment of this. There will come a time once again, people will say, "I am Joseph, your brother." There's actually a manuscript, an unpublished manuscript by Dr. Rick Sherritt, in that title. You can find it on the internet. But you know, that's a different topic. Joseph extended mercy. Jacob went to Egypt. Jacob dwelled in Egypt. Jacob then, in chapter 48, blessed and adopted Joseph's sons, who were genetically half Egyptian. And they became Ephraim, Manasseh, prominent tribes in the among the Israelites. And then in chapter 49, Jacob blessed his progeny. Jacob made Joseph swear that he would take him back and bury him with his fathers. And there was 70 days of mourning, which you can read that in the story. But, you know, on the topic of goodness and mercy following me all the days of my life, I'd just like to read to you chapter 50, verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "Perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all the evil which they did to him." This is a remarkable psychological thing that happens. People who accuse other people falsely more often than not are guilty of the very thing that they accuse others of. Maybe you've noticed that. If you haven't, watch that. You know, if you get falsely accused or someone is accusing someone else falsely, I have tested it often enough that I automatically go to, I wonder. And then you let it prove it out. They hated Joseph. We read that at the beginning of the story. So they thought he would hate them. "Perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him." So they sent messengers to Joseph saying, "Before your father died, he commanded saying, 'Thus you shall say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sin, for they did evil to you.'" There is no record of Jacob actually having said that. Perhaps he did. Perhaps they made it up. I mean, they were capable of it. "In any case, now please forgive the trespass of your servants, of the God of your father." And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also went and fell down before his face. "Behold, we are your servants." And Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God?" You know, if you read the Bible, there are really only, you know, Daniel is the only personality that I know that for which I have not found fault enumerated. Most of the big personalities in the Bible had numerous faults. Joseph was a close second. He had the power to do anything. Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God. So despite the power that he had, he recognized that God exacted vengeance. "But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring it about as it is this day, to save many people alive. Now therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones." And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. The psalmist concludes, "And I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." And I'd like to just project this forward a little bit in Ezekiel chapter 37. After the millennium, after the great resurrection to life of Israelites in particular, and just in conclusion, I'll read a section here because it shows that this psalm that has so much depth that it has spanned and fascinated people for millennia also projects the metaphor, if you will, has impact in the future. Verse 16 of chapter 37. "And as for you, son of man, take a stick for yourself and write on for Judah and for the children of Israel and his companions." And then he said, "Take another stick and write on it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and for all the house of Israel and his companions. Then join them one another for yourself into one stick, and they will become one in your hand. And when the children of your people speak to you, saying, 'Will you not show us what this means?' say to them, 'Thus says the Lord God, surely I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribes of Israel and his companions, and I will join them with it, and with the stick of Judah, and make them one stick, and they will be one in my hand.'" I mean, here's the point here. You have a family that did all kinds of horrible things, and yet God somehow worked it out and has the capacity in the future to make what we are about to read happen. "And the sticks in which you write will be on your hand before their eyes, and then say to them, 'Thus says the Lord, surely I will take the children of Israel from among the nations wherever they have gone, and gather them from every side and bring them into their own land.'" The obvious thing that is unspoken here is the fact that descendants of the children of Israel have to have lived down through time in order for this to be able to happen. "And I will make them one in a nation in the land on the mountain of Israel, and one king shall be king over them all. They shall no longer be two nations, nor shall they be ever to be divided into two kingdoms again. They shall not defile themselves anymore with their idols, nor with their detestable things, nor with any of their transgressions. But I will deliver them from all their dwelling places in which they have sinned, and will cleanse them. Then they shall be my people, and I shall be their God. David, my servant, shall be their king over them, and they shall have one shepherd. They also walk in my judgments and observe my statutes and do them." Just a quick thought. In the whole conversation about where the sons of Jacob were to settle in the land, Joseph said, "Move here, because shepherds are an abomination to the Egyptians." And this is a remarkable statement about leadership. Whether it's the leadership of Pharaoh on a pyramidal structure or a shepherd who cares for his sheep. David will be a shepherd over them, even though he carries the title of king. Then they shall dwell in the land that I have given to Jacob my servant, where your fathers dwell, and they shall dwell there, they, their children, and their children's children forever. My servant David shall be their prince forever. Moreover, I will make with them a covenant of peace with them, and it shall be an everlasting covenant with them. I will establish them and multiply them, and I will set my sanctuary in their midst forever. My tabernacle also shall be with them. Indeed, I will be their God, and they shall be my people. The nations also will know that I am the Lord, that I, the Lord, sanctify Israel when my sanctuary is in their midst forever. That's the conclusion to the story, and it is consistent with Psalm chapter 23. Because the psalm that says, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you will be with me, concludes by saying, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. And of that, we can be certain.